So we're looking at 1 Timothy chapter 3. Open your Bibles to that. I invite you to turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3 this morning. 1 Timothy chapter 3. We began talking about elders a few weeks ago, about 4 weeks ago now. And some things that interrupted that, so I'm sorry about that. And in that first lesson, we considered the work of an elder, the shepherding of that he does. And I did that deliberately because I thought it would be nice to see the work that he does and then consider the qualifications that you need to do that kind of work and how they apply to that. And so today, I want us to look at the qualifications that Paul gave to Timothy, and perhaps next week as well. I'm not going to rush through these, so 12 o'clock comes, we're going to quit. We'll do some more next week, but I don't want to rush through this. So, I made two preliminary observations that we can make as we look at this subject. And first of all, that is that God desires elders in His churches. Acts chapter 14, verse 23, Paul appointed elders in every church. He sent letters to Timothy and to Titus, and he told them to appoint elders and set things in order that are lacking. And of course, if you look through the book of Acts, and even in at least seven letters of the New Testament, elders are talked about in some aspect of their work or their qualifications are discussed. So God desires elders in His churches. That was part of His plan. But at the same time, God does not say just anyone will do. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 already, He had discussed that women were not given the leadership roles in first century churches. 1 Timothy 2 verse 9 and 10. And then he talked about the men that could lead in chapter 3, and we learned that only men of certain kind of maturity, spiritual maturity, are able to serve in this capacity. So there's two, I think, observations that I wanted you to notice. And he's going to follow that with almost 15, depends on how you count them, qualifications or qualities of the men that God says can serve. Taking a quick glance at the overall list that he made in this text, I want you to notice that it emphasizes the kind of man that he must be. The quality of the man. It's not merely a checklist of qualifications, but it's a type of man, a quality of person that God wants to have overseeing His people. And you can see that there's a number of things. We'll talk about each of those. But the other thing I want you to notice, look to chapter 3 and verse 1. He says, it's a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it's a fine work that he desires to do. That's in the New American Standard Version. He doesn't crave it. He doesn't campaign for it. He doesn't seek it like a honorary title. It's not a political office that a man is trying to get. It's a work that God determined is important to the maturity of His saints. He chose to place that as part of His the things that need to be in a church. And so a man may aspire to that kind of work. And I think that's a good thing. Paul said it's a fine thing if a man aspires to be that. But I think when people aspire to it, it's with a certain amount of fear. Because this is a man who will have to give an account for the souls that he is going to watch over from Hebrews chapter 13. So it's a fearful thing as he approaches that idea of being an elder in a congregation. So I want us to look at these characteristics of the man who would be an elder, and we'll stop in a little bit. Let's look at the first one. He says in chapter 3, if you look there, and verse 1, he is a man who needs to be above reproach. I put the on the left side, I put some of the different translations, kind of like when we were talking this morning in our Bible class. The King James Version said he needs to be blameless. The Amplified Bible, that's a little bit less literal, but it gives a little more explanation, says he gives no grounds for accusation. The New American Standard and the NIV both say he is above reproach. And literally, when I looked that word up, as I mentioned in Bible class, it meant to take hold of or to grasp or to catch. And the passage that seemed to reflect that idea best to me is in Luke chapter 20 and verse 20. When Jesus says, and they watched him, they watched Jesus, and sent spies who pretended to be righteous men that they might seize on his words. The King James Version says, take hold of his words. And the New American Standard said, catch him in some statement. That's the idea of looking for reproach in someone, to be able to seize them in something that was they had done that was wrong. They couldn't do that with Jesus. There were no justifiable accusations that could be made. Now, there are always going to be critics. There were plenty of critics in that day, and there are people who are going to try to look and make accusations. But in this case, they couldn't find fault. And that's the idea here, that a man who would be an elder must be above reproach, where there's nothing that someone can take hold of, some kind of inappropriate conduct, some kind of justifiable criticism that that someone could use to bring him down. You see that? He must be above reproach. Blameless. That doesn't mean sinless. I think if blameless meant sinless, then nobody would be qualified, would it? We couldn't even have elders. But he is a man who would deal with his sins just as the Scripture says. But you know, I think above reproach needs further definition. And we're not really left here to define that for ourselves, but he gives some illustrations of that. For example, here's another one, that he is to be the husband of one wife. Now, as you can see here, this has been interpreted in various ways. There are different views on what it means to be a husband of one wife. Basically, I put four views that's been adopted as to what Paul means by that. And the first one that people suggest is that he is a faithful, devoted husband. The New International Version says, faithful to his wife. That is, that he would not be a playboy, would not be an adulterer, he wouldn't be a flirt, he doesn't have sexual or emotional or romantic interest in other women, including depictions of women in pornography. And the term that's literally translated is a one-woman man. And the idea would be is that he is a faithful, devoted husband, a one-woman man. And I think that view has a lot of merit. It reflects the overall emphasis on the character and the reputation of a man who the group would appoint as an elder. He is above reproach, blameless, as it applies to his marriage. But there's another view, too, and that some people think, and that is that he is to have one wife, not two, not three, not four. That he's making a prohibition against polygamy here. Certainly that's an important characteristic. The overall Bible teaching would emphasize that God does not approve of polygamous marriages. But it is so obviously important for all Christians that it raises some question as to whether Paul meant that when he said this. Polygamy was not generally practiced in the Roman world, and so it would be less likely to have been an issue in the churches. The third possibility, the third view that students of this passage have taken, is that it means that he can be married only once in a lifetime. Some would take it as inappropriate for a widower, a man whose wife has died, to then be remarried and to be an elder. Some would take it as inappropriate for a divorced man who even divorced according to Jesus' law and remarried to be an elder, that they can only have one spouse their whole life, the husband of one wife. There are at least a couple of challenges with that. First of all, you might think about how you would say that. If we wanted to say that an elder could only have one wife in his lifetime, you might say he has been the husband of only one wife, or he has been married only once. It seems like you might need a past tense to clarify that that's what you meant. It doesn't mention any exceptions in this text. Some people would say, this text, husband of one wife, just means one wife for a lifetime, because he doesn't mention any of the exceptions that is mentioned in the Gospels. But you know what? If we took a moment and went back to read Mark chapter 10, and we might do that. Why don't we turn back very quickly to Mark chapter 10? And why don't we read beginning in verse 6, and we'll read down through verse 12. Mark chapter 10, verse 6 through 12. He says, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. And in the house, the disciples began to question him about that again. And he said, whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she herself divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. You know, if we read that text, and forget the study on elders, just, and this is what we read, and we were studying Mark, and that's all we read, you would come away with the same conclusion. That God only approves of one marriage, one man, one wife, without any exceptions at all, once in a lifetime. But normally, when we study something like that, we take into account all the Bible says about that teaching. We would refer to Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, where Jesus said that if a man puts his wife away for the cause of adultery, then he could marry again. And we would say, also, we would look at Romans chapter 7, where when a man's wife passed away, then that law of marriage has been broken, and Paul gave permission through the Lord, the Holy Spirit, for him to marry again. And so, Jesus was teaching in Mark chapter 10, the husband of one wife. I think that's what he's teaching. One man, one woman for life. But that does not disallow what he taught in other places through his apostles. And I think only if the text demands it should we be, not allow anything else to be considered other than what it says in that text. If you allow for a second marriage, somebody might say, if you allow for a second marriage, then doesn't that add the element of reproach? That now, with a second marriage, that necessarily means there's something that someone can take hold of and accuse him of. Well, to the degree that there are any questions about his remarriage, it makes him less qualified. If there is something about that that causes someone that they can take hold of or seize to accuse him justifiably, then I certainly think that a group has a right to say he is not above reproach. But a scriptural remarriage is in itself not a reproach. If you look over again in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 14, in the same letter, when Paul writes a little bit later and he writes to those who are widows, those whose husbands have died, he says to the younger widows in verse 14, therefore I want younger widows to get married, to bear children, to keep house, and to give the enemy no cause for reproach. And so here, Paul is instructing that that is the best thing for widows to remarry, because it prevents them from falling into reproach. And then one final passage in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39, in a similar way, when Paul instructs about some more to the Corinthians about remarriage, he says in verse 39, a wife is bound as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. So there is no reproach intrinsically connected to a second marriage as long as it's something that God has authorized. So at least I struggle a little bit to take that third view in light of that particular, those thoughts. And then the last passage, or the last view that's taken, is that it's just a requirement that he be married. that a husband of one wife just means that the person needs to be married. And again, I think about how you would say that if you wanted to make that point. And if you wanted just to say he has to be married, then he could have said he has to be a husband of a wife. But he doesn't say that. He says a husband of one wife. And that one is in the emphatic position, at least in the Greek. It's a one woman man. So he assumes that he's married, not that he just needs to be married. I think if I was going to say the position that I'm most comfortable with right now, I would personally think number one is what Paul is pointing at, that he is a faithful, devoted husband. It would certainly be a scriptural marriage, one that God approved of, but that man must be a one-woman man. He is a faithful, devoted husband, which I think is the point of the emphasis in this text. The next quality that he mentions after that is that he is temperate. The third characteristic is that he is temperate, which means, if you look that word up, again, I told you this is kind of a word study. You look that up and see what it means. And the King James Version says that he is vigilant, and the Amplified Bible says he is circumspect. New disciples don't tend to have this character trait. Matthew chapter 26 and verse 41, you might remember in the garden that Jesus told his apostles, he said, watch and pray, be on guard, look around you, be alert, watch and pray. And they went to sleep. And so they weren't really, if temperate there is to communicate the idea of being watchful, to be vigilant, to be circumspect, at least at that point, they weren't at that place in their faith. But you know, elders are not men who have always shown temperance. Elders are men who have grown up. Peter spoke to the elders in 1 Peter chapter 5 as an elder himself. And he tells the young men, be sober, be vigilant, for the devil walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he might devour. See, Peter grew up. Peter was not temperate or vigilant that day in the garden. But by the time he was writing that letter, he had grown up. So I think it's important that we don't count a man out or give him, because he lacked some of these qualities at an earlier age. We need to give someone time to mature and season. God does. And Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17, he adds that to be an elder, a man must have developed that characteristic. They need to be vigilant, for they watch over the souls that have been given to them. And so it's important to have this characteristic of being temperate. The next characteristic that he mentions is the characteristic of being prudent. 1 Timothy again, chapter 3. He says an elder must be prudent. The King James Version says sober minded or sober, and the New International Version says self-controlled. That literally, when you look that word up, means to be of sound mind, be in one's right mind. It's interesting that it was used by Jesus to describe the man who had, or not by Jesus, but the gospel writer, to describe the man that Jesus healed who had a demon. He was out of his mind, but after Jesus healed him, he was in his right mind. He was sober, he was self-controlled. So self-controlled is used of a person who is in possession of himself. He's reined in his passions. He's reined in his emotions. He is prudent. The next characteristic, the fifth characteristic, is respectable, of good behavior or well-behaved, as these other two translations render it. The idea is that he is an orderly person. It's interestingly the same word that's used in chapter 2 and verse 9 of women when it says that they are modest in the apparel that they wear. It's the same word. Here's a person who is dignified in his conduct, not in the sense of being a stuffed shirt, but he has a certain decorum about his person. He is respectable. He is well-behaved. He is of good behavior. And you can see how these kind of qualities are important to the work of someone who is going to be a shepherd who's going to lead God's people. Next, he is hospitable. That's the sixth quality that's mentioned. It means a person who opens his home to others. The word literally translated it meant lover of strangers. And especially perhaps an important quality in the early church when they did not have hotels and motels where people could find overnight accommodations. Christians traveling from place to place, one place to another, often was dependent on staying with other Christians in the homes of other people. And perhaps even traveling preachers had to look for the hospitality of others. I'll look at a passage in 3 John. I like this passage. John writes a short letter to a man named Gaius. And he commends him because he seems to have this quality. 3 John, verse 5 to 8. He says, "Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish to the brethren, and especially when they are strangers, and they bear witness to your love before the church, and you will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. For they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, you ought to support each man, that we might be fellow workers with the truth." Perhaps there he has in mind some teachers or preachers that had gone out. But the man is commended because he opened his home and he showed hospitality and had those people into his home. And so that's an important characteristic of a man that would be an elder or an overseer in a congregation. Not that he just can put a little check mark. Yes, he had someone over to his house last year once. But that his nature is that of a man who's hospitable, who opens his home and has people into his home. Another is that he is able to teach. 1 Timothy, again, going back to that passage. 1 Timothy chapter 3, that he is able to teach. It's used of elders and preachers. If you took time and turned over to 2 Timothy 2, verse 24, that in that text too, it says they are able to teach. Interesting, the King James Version uses the phrase apt to teach. I don't think what that's intended to communicate is that that if nobody else shows up, then Fred's apt to teach. I don't think that's the idea. But that he has some ability, he has some skill at that ability at the work of teaching. Look over, if you would, at Titus chapter 1, verse 9 through 11. Titus chapter 1, verse 9 through 11. He talks about the need to be able to teach as he describes the work of elders or overseers in this text. He says that they hold fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, that he may be able to both exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict. For there are many rebellious men, empty talkers, deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, who must be silenced because they are upsetting whole families, teaching things they should not teach for the sake of sordid gain. So here's a man who needs to have some ability to explain the truth and to defend the truth. Churches have at times hired preachers, kind of like hired gunslingers, to combat false doctrine and false teachers. But you know, the text to me indicates that the principal responsibility of that lies with the elders, who are to oversee and protect and defend the flock, though certainly the preachers do the same kind of work as well. But they are the defenders and the protectors of the sheep against the wolves. So, though Peter will say an elder must be an example to the flock in 1 Peter chapter 5, Paul would add here that while that is a part of it, it's not sufficient. He must be skilled also at giving instruction. And the word that's used means with a gift for teaching. He's at least developed that ability to teach others. Going back to the next characteristic, is not given to wine. Not given to wine. This is an interesting characteristic of elders. The New American Standard translates that not addicted to wine, and the New International Version translates that not given to drunkenness. He's not a drunkard, the English Standard Version says. Well, Paul is prohibiting here, some have said, excessive, heavy wine drinking, and therefore he is condoning moderate drinking of wine. And some will look at this and say, besides that, if you turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 24, he tells Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach. Well, there are a lot of good reasons to be a total abstainer from drinking alcoholic beverages. For one, for the sake of our testimony about what Christianity is, that's a good reason to not have anything to do with any kind of wine. Secondly, the possibility of becoming enslaved to alcohol, even if you're not. And thirdly, by giving an impression that is not glorifying to God. Those are good, solid reasons to not ever have anything to do with alcoholic beverages. And yes, Paul did tell Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach, for the stomach's sake, in chapter 5. But I want you to notice that when he said that, he said he did have to tell him to do it, number one. And secondly, he told him to take a little wine, number two. And thirdly, he told him to take it more for a medicinal purpose, number three. And so, no, this may not be an absolute prohibition in this text against drinking of wine in the first century. But I think it's also very fair on our part to admit that the kind of wine that they used was very different than the wine that we use and we buy in liquor stores today. The wine they used was very weak in their day. It was watered down, sometimes 20 parts to one. That's a lot of documentation that shows that. Due to bugs in the water, just like there are still today in some countries, they use that to purify the water that they would drink. And that seems to be more like the kind of drinking that Paul would have advocated to Timothy in chapter 5, rather than social drinking that some people would say that we're able to do today. And it's also fair to admit that our modern alcoholic beverages usually would fall more into the category of, in the first century, what they would know as strong drink. It's much higher in alcoholic content than the wine in the New Testament when these instructions were given. And strong drink was absolutely forbidden in the Bible. And particularly those who were priests in Israel, they weren't supposed to even touch wine. And are we not supposed to be priests in the house of God? Isn't that the application for us today? So, I would just ask the simple question as you think about this quality of a person as it pertains to an elder today or a man who's a priest in God's kingdom. If he's to be above reproach and he drinks alcoholic beverages, would you consider him to be a leader among your people? Is there nothing in his character that someone might seize upon and take hold of to make some justifiable accusations of impropriety today if that man participated in drinking alcoholic beverages? I would suggest that there would be. Another quality would be gentle or not quarrelsome. I kind of may have combined the two here. I'm not sure. The New International, one version says it's not pugnacious. I'm sorry. Maybe I skipped one here. Well, I have gentle and not quarrelsome. That translates as no striker in the King James Version. Not combative is the translation in the Amplified Bible, or peaceable. That's how that characteristic is rendered. I think I skipped one that said not pugnacious. That may have been the previous one. But the idea is someone who isn't quarrelsome, who doesn't fight, doesn't start a fight. The pugnacious man is a man who's difficult to get along with. He's always starting a fight. He's always looking for an argument. He's always ready to take you on in something. But the man who would be appointed as an elder should have the reputation to be a gentle person, a peacemaker, a man who desires and works for peace. Some qualities that he mentions here seems to be more absolute, like not violent. But in other cases, when he says someone who is gentle, that seems to be a little bit more of a judgmental thing that you have to decide, that a congregation has to decide. One man may be more gentle than another man. The question is this man gentle enough that you think he could take care of the flock of God and help them out? And so I think there is judgment that has to be made as you look at some of these characteristics. Is this man gentle enough to lead the people of God? And then another quality is not greedy. 1 Timothy chapter 3, he says that he is to be not greedy. Or free from the love of money is another way that that's translated. King James Version puts it, not greedy of filthy lucre. A little bit more obscure, but when you look at the translations together, it's not hard to see what the point is that's being made there. You'd think that'd be kind of obvious, wouldn't you? That he shouldn't be a greedy person. You might notice that it's when it says no lover of money, that's really what he's talking about. It's not the possession of it that's the disqualifying factor. It's that he doesn't love it. Poor people as well as rich people may love money, but not all rich people love money. Some people become rich because of virtue of hard work, and they're rewarded by their companies for doing diligent labor, and they pay them well for that. The opposite, of course, would be someone who is greedy, would be content with what you have. And Paul talks about that. Turn over one page to 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7 and 8, where he says, "For we have brought nothing into the world, so we can take nothing out of it either. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content." And so Paul suggests in another place in this letter that we must be content with what we have. That would be the opposite of greedy. Let me suggest to you a kind of a litmus test for you for your love of money. It seems to me that sometimes people who really love money tip their hand in the way they talk about it. Sometimes people will bring money into the conversation quite often. And I think that shows that money is very important to them. Maybe you've known someone who brings money into the conversation before very long. Even when that's not what the conversation is about. And it shows that this person has money on the mind. This is a very important and central part of this person's life. So how much time and attention do I give to money? That may reflect my love of it or my lack of love of it. Well, another characteristic is that he manages or rules his household well. And so this he comes back to a family consideration here. And that means that a man has control of his family. The members of his household submit to him out of respect for him. An elder's responsibilities to the church are quite parental, if you would use that word. A pastor sort of parents people in a spiritual sense. And so an elder should have proven his ability in the home before he is given a larger responsibility in the church. His home is the proving ground for church leadership. And Paul adds in verse 5 of 1 Timothy chapter 3, "But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God?" It's a very important test of a man's ability in leadership of the church is his leadership of his family. Children here, I think, are assumed in this text. In Titus chapter 1, if you turn over there just quickly, Titus chapter 1 and verse 6, it says, "And for this reason I remind you," that's 2 Timothy, Titus chapter 1, verse 6. He says, "Namely, if any man has above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion." And so he adds here, children who believe, or faithful children, if you have the King James Version. And I think that suggests that they're to be more than just merely well-behaved or obedient to the Father, but they're to be led to the Lord. They are Christians. And the question that we raise here is, can he lead God's spiritual family? How did he do with his physical family? That's the question that we're asking. Do you go to a man and ask his counsel on how to raise godly children if his children aren't God-fearing believers, if he hasn't raised them to be godly himself? It's not mere, and I want you to notice, it's not merely the kids here who have been baptized, that they're just members of the church. But these children are ones who are in submission with all reverence, and they're not accused of dissipation or rebellion. They are obviously faithful children. They're ones who have submitted to not only the Father, but submitted to the Lord. You know, often about this point, we don't get any further than this in a study of elders. Many questions a lot of times are raised at this point when it comes to talking about children. I put just a few of the many questions that people will raise at this point. They'll say, well, how many children must he have? They'll say, are two or more necessary? They'll raise the question, must they all be faithful before he can be appointed? Someone may say, what if a child falls away after he leaves home? Another question is, what if all his children die in some tragic accident after leaving home? Is he disqualified? Someone would say, if the wife dies and he's disqualified, well, that would have to be true about the husband, about the children, if the children died too, it seems to me. What if an elder has an unexpected child late in life? Does that disqualify him from being, does that take away from what he's proven beforehand? What if he adopts children later on? You know, I probably could have made a couple of pages of lists of these questions that people ask about at this point. But I'm not going to answer these, all these questions. I think they're good questions. I think they're valid questions. I have a conviction about those, and they're certainly something that someone should discuss. We should discuss them if we like. But you know, clearly, when you look at this text, Paul did not divert his attention from the overall portrait of that man by dealing with all of these questions. The question is, what are we looking for? That's what we're saying. What are we looking for here? We are looking for a man who, in their own family, has shown that they can exert a moral and spiritual influence on others. Here is a man over here, and I look at him, and I look at his family, and I say, there is no question this man has ruled his household well. When I look at his children, I can say, here's a man who exerted a moral and a spiritual influence on his children. And I want you to notice here that it says, Paul said, it is the man who has done this. You know, sometimes we can make this so much into just a checklist that we'll say, well, how many kids does he have? And have they been baptized? And we never bother to ask, was it him or was it his wife who exerted the moral and spiritual influence on those kids? Maybe he had very little to do with their upbringing, while she is the spiritual leader in the family. We are looking, Paul said, for a man who has shown in his family leadership, a man who has the ability to influence people for good, a man who has led his wife and led his children, and it is clear to the congregation that he knows how. Verse 5, again, Paul made the point to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 5. He said, for if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? So when a congregation has new Christians or problem children, as sometimes it does, can they look to him and know that he will know the best way to help them, that he's had experience with that and done that well? When members have struggles with their own children, Can they look to him as an example and say, how did you do this? And humbly, that man will say, well, here are some ideas. Here are some suggestions. Or he's able to open God's Word and say, you know, here are the principles that I used, and here are some suggestions about how you might apply that. You see, Paul was concerned with character, and he was concerned with proven character. This is a man who has been tested, he has developed, and he has demonstrated the know-how. He has ruled his own house well, and he has shown himself capable of leading God's house. The next, so be careful to answer such questions, these kind of questions, as I said, they're all valid, good questions, but be sure and answer them only as they bear upon the quality of the man and how that reflects on his ability or inability to lead God's house. The next one, and I think maybe almost the end one, so let's look at these. The next one is to not be a new convert. That means, literally, it was interesting, the word meant not newly planted. Another translation said, not a novice or a recent convert. This one requires a kind of a judgment call, as all of these qualifications do. They're not black and white things, but require a good bit of judgment in assessing how well a person does this. The question here is, how new, perhaps, would be the question. Is he supposed to be a Christian for a year or 5 years or 10 years? Paul doesn't say, does he? But in view of the spirit of this, what he's saying, there should be evidence that he can function as an elder, that he can function by leading and teaching and defending the faith without becoming, interestingly, conceited. That's a passage. If you look back down here again in chapter 3, he says in verse 6, and not a new convert, lest he become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And so that's Paul's special concern, that he not become conceited. When people are looking to you for leadership, and they look to you for help, and they come to you for your judgment on things and your understanding, it's easy to become conceited. The King James Version says, lifted up with pride. And especially for a new convert. Conceit, he says, is what puts Satan where he is. And so a new Christian or a new convert should be guarded from that by being kept back from some premature, I think, appointment as elders. The elders Paul appointed probably, I think this is interesting, probably had some background in Judaism. I think it's interesting to think about Paul going into some unevangelized area and preaching the gospel and people being baptized, and then before he leaves town, he appoints elders. How do you do that? How can that be if new converts are not supposed to be appointed? Well, I would suggest the possibility that because these new converts in many cases had years of background in as Jewish believers, that they knew the scriptures, some of them. But it's amazing how well Jewish believers knew the scriptures, a lot better than us, perhaps. And it's amazing how well Jewish believers knew these scriptures by heart. And some were rulers of the synagogue already, like Crispus that was converted, that Paul baptized. So chronologically, if you want to look at it chronologically, they may have been new Christians, but they may not have been new believers in God. And even though we might safely assume many already had a character that was godly and mature, as Paul was describing here, even Gentile believers may have already had developed a good quality of character, some of these characteristics that he mentions here, like Cornelius, who is highly commended by the Jews as someone who was a godly man. Or the centurion, perhaps, whose servant Jesus healed. There are already men of great character and men of integrity. And then the final thing is that he be a man, he mentions here in verse 8, or verse 7, that he must have a good reputation with those outside the church, so that he may not fall into the reproach and snare of the devil. Especially, I think, we talk about here when it says those outside the church. We're talking about those who are not Christians, those who are unbelievers. And that's essential. Why? Well, because you don't want him to bring reproach upon the Lord or upon the church itself. So you might raise questions. Is he a person who pays his bills? Is he honest? Is he straightforward in his business dealings and with the community? Does he have a good credit record? He needs to be above reproach with those in the community so that the church will not fall into criticism and be looked down upon by the community that surrounds it because of the type of man that they have as their leader. And so, you know, as we study these qualifications of an elder, it becomes clear, I think, that there are two things that are very important to Paul. First of all, that the man not be guilty of doing something that's wrong. And secondly, beyond that, that this man was conscientious in such that his conduct was perceived by everyone as proper for a Christian. You know, it isn't just what he does or what he did or didn't do, but how he is perceived by others. Because his example would be very important as it was a reflection not only of the Lord, but of the church over which he was to be shepherding. Well, again, I hope this was helpful to think about this again and these different qualities of a man who would be an elder. A few weeks ago, I passed out a sheet for everybody to make notations on it about those men here that you may think already are qualified. And then a second question was, do you see any men who are working toward that end, and just with some refining and some maturity may be qualified in the future? And I'm going to pass that sheet out again, because I think as we, I asked that in the preliminary sense as you thought about the work of an elder, but I want you to think about it again as you look at these qualities that characterize a man who would be God would approve as a leader over the people of God. And I didn't bring those today, I didn't make copies of those, but I'll make copies of those and we'll pass those out to you, if not today, not today, but perhaps next week. So thank you for your attention. If you want to get a song book out, I think we have a song that Bill has selected for us.